So, Rebecca, we are at the very tail end of Omicron, hopefully. So, or as Omicron, as you called it the last time we talked on the podcast. And so this might be the very, very last time we have to podcast remotely, hopefully, right, Rebecca?
I mean, are you taking bets? I don't know. Yeah. I'm still buying N95 masks, like they're going out of business.
I know. Who knows? Let's hope. Let's hope.
So holding on to hope.
You texted me the other day and you were like, we got to talk about the Super Bowl halftime show with Dr. Dre. What do you want to talk about, Rebecca?
Well, there were so many details that we could focus on. First, I'm wondering if you noticed when the Pepsi logo went up, I believe that was MC Light introducing them.
I don't even know who MC Light is.
What?
Who
is MC Light? This is MC Light. Well, very important. One of the first female hip hop artists went on to be a radio personality. So I just want to say, like, you know, just another example of every moment of that experience was like dredging the details. Like it was just, because I was thinking in my head about like Katy Perry's performance on The Huge Tiger. You know, there was nothing personal about that. Right. Whereas switch to Dr. Dre, like the entire floor of the arena is a map of Compton.
Right.
And then the set is a strip of six businesses in someone's house.
Right.
And then when Snoop Dogg goes down to perform in his house, it's photos of his grandma on the wall.
Yeah.
And then they come out and they do a tribute to Tupac. You know, I mean, it was just like detail upon detail about Dr. Dre's story.
Yeah.
His life.
Yeah. Yeah. I was trying to think of a time where I enjoyed the halftime show. So for those who don't know, because we have, I think half of our listeners are outside the States, there's this thing called American football, and it's it's not where you kick a round ball, it's where you throw an oblong ball. And there's this thing called the Super Bowl, which is the championship game that happens in the January or beginning of February every year. And it has a long tradition in American culture with certain people where you, even people who don't watch football will watch the Super Bowl for the seven-layer dip and the commercials and the talking points and the halftime show. And so the halftime show over the past 20, 30 years has become more and more of a sensation. I actually looked at the history of the halftime show just to see all the people who played. And do you know what, like, the first 20 years of the halftime show involved in the 60s, 70s, 80s?
I remember it as kind of an up with people, music medley, thousands of dancers, a lot of flags.
Right. Exactly.
No big names, though.
Exactly. No big names. It was because that's traditionally in college football, which is where NFL kind of, you know, emerges from to some extent, the culture of it with cheerleaders and all that kind of stuff, is that you would have a band play. You would have a marching band and you'd have flags and dancers, and it wouldn't be like a particular star. And then do you know the first star that played?
I believe it was Michael Jackson.
Soon before that it was,
okay,
he was one of the first for sure, but it was the Rockettes and Chubby Checker in 1988. So before that it was all like, you know, A World of Children's Dreams in 1985, which was just a medley of different songs, right? And different dancers and band, blah, blah, blah. And then but Chubby Checker, Rockettes, but the big splash first stars that played, that's kind of in the modern era of the Super Bowl halftime show, was 1991, New Kids on the Block.
Oh, boy. I completely have no memory of that one.
Neither do I. According to the internet, it's one of the most hated halftime shows. But then, yeah, you fast forward to some notable halftime shows with Michael Jackson, 1993, which is, you know, soon after New Kids on the Block.
And I'm curious if that's when it became the Pepsi halftime show, because if you'll remember, right, that was the Pepsi ad where his hair gets burned. And,
right. Yeah. Prince 2007 was famous.
Very memorable.
Because he's just an electric. I mean, I don't think we'll ever see a better live performer than Prince in the entire, you know, rest of human history. He is an amazing singer, guitarist, drummer, dancer, stylist, lyricist, songwriter. He's
fashion innovator.
Yeah, he's just amazing. And so the famous story about that performance is that it, before he went on, they were like, you know, it's raining, so are you sure you want to go on? And I can't remember what he said, but he was just like, yeah, I mean, that'll make it harder for me. I need a challenge. So I can't remember what but it was something very inspirational. And, you know, it was in the rain. He's playing guitar live and singing in the rain without a cover, you know, and he's Purple Rain, of course, he's singing. Anyway, Beyonce 2013.
Well, hold on the Prince. There's a little bit more trivia on that show. So after he passed away, Prince's, all of his musicians and everything are getting archived. And they open up the guitar from that show, and it's full of water still.
Oh my God. That is interesting. Beyonce 2013, Jennifer Lopez, Shakira 2020.
Don't forget Bruno Mars. That was an incredible halftime show.
Yeah. Well, as a half Asian person myself, I, you know, consider Mars to be a fellow half Asian brother, half a brother. And I loved that show.
Because he's also half Jewish, so we share him.
Okay. He's like we had a child. It's like it's our
with
child.
With a Puerto Rican, another part, but yeah. Yes.
And the really cool thing about that show was that he plays drums live, and he's amazing. Mm. I didn't even know he was a drummer. He's like a really good drummer, which, you know, I thought was pretty great. So now, in this... So when you were watching it, how were you feeling?
You know, that is the music. I mean, I am right there. I saw a statistic of how old they are. So Mary J and I are the same age. We're both 51. We're both Capricorns. And so I've always been incredibly moved by her music. But all of those guys are like, I think, you know, obviously the youngest is...
Kendrick Lamar.
Kendrick Lamar, who's 35. I mean, I also thought it was interesting how many of them changed their lyrics to fit the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Which isn't something that's usually done at a halftime show, but speaks to hip hop. Like, this is of my moment, of my place.
Deft they are at adjusting, you know? Like, when Kendrick Lamar went into the Dre verse at the end, I was just like... Wow, I mean, that actually sounds pretty good. It didn't sound shoehorned in, kind of a thing. Yeah, I mean, so for me, I'm watching it, and, to full disclosure, when Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, were on the scene in the 90s, early 90s, it wasn't really my bag. I was listening to the Posies and Smashing Pumpkins, you know. I mean, I certainly knew of their music and didn't hate it, but it just wasn't my scene or really anyone around me. But as time has gone on, I've come to, you know, appreciate it and really like it. And as I was watching, and when Kendrick Lamar came out, that really pinnacle album, seminal album, of all the albums I really liked. If I was to, you know, sit down and listen to something, I think I would sit down and listen to Kendrick Lamar more than any of the other artists. Although there's a certain kind of period of Eminem that is pretty compelling to me. But that
hasn't
really...
Have you gone back and listened to Mary J's full library?
No.
And her new album is really amazing. Gorgeous. Good Morning Gorgeous it's amazing. Yeah. I have some Kendrick Lamar trivia, so tell me when you're ready for it.
Give me.
Okay, so, God, what year is it? Eli's probably six. And the Science Center at Seattle had a special, they would do these evening babysitting, where it made it really great, because if there was something fun happening at Seattle Center, you could drop your kid off, go to the event with your partner, and then come and pick your kid up. Well, what's happening that night? But Kanye West is in concert at the Kingdom. I mean, not at the Kingdom, at the Key Arena. And someone I've never heard of is opening for him. This kid named Kendrick Lamar. I've never heard of Kendrick Lamar. So it's that famous show at the Key Arena where he started 3 hours late. Do you remember this?
No.
So they are, he chooses Seattle to start the show, start the tour, because they've named their daughter Northwest. Mm. So they start in Seattle. They're 3 hours late to start the show, which means we never got to see Yeezy as he was at that time. This was the show that he played completely in a mask. Do you remember any of this?
No.
Super crazy. We missed all that. But so we only got to see the opening act, Kendrick Lamar.
So you see Kendrick, he comes on time, I'm guessing.
Yeah. No, and the whole thing starts 3 hours late.
Oh, so why'd you leave? Because it was just too late or something?
Yeah, we had to go pick up our kid. Like, it wasn't like, can you hold our kid a little bit longer? We're here seeing. So everyone else in the entire arena. And you know, like sometimes for the opening act, all the lights are on. And
yeah.
So all the lights are on. We're the only people in the whole arena that don't know every single lyric. It must have been his first album. Mm. But I was clear, like, who is this? Like, this kid Kendrick is going places.
Yeah.
So then when that next album came out, we were totally into it. That was that Butterfly was the name of it, or
I'm not great. Okay. the album with All Right on it, the song that he performed.
So our kid was totally into that album. We listened to it a ton. I love that album. And then that was the year it didn't win for best album. Adele won instead.
Right.
And my kid was heartbroken. And so I told them the story of the year Milli Vanilli won for best new artist. Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah.
And one of the people they beat out was the Indigo Girls. So it was a big conversation about how maybe the Grammys aren't that fair and maybe don't reflect.
Well, not right. Not only that. Well, one, the Grammys aren't fair. Two, it's not like a popularity contest. There are judges and they're just like, this is what we're going to choose. And so you just imagine that there are many more Adele fans than there are Kendrick Lamar fans on that panel. I mean, clearly, because that's
she keeps winning.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, I was thinking about this halftime show, and I can't remember a time where I enjoyed it so much. I mean, it was they planned it so well because there was no low point. It just kept, it was pretty brief, actually. I rewatched it today and I was like, wow, I think it's only like 15 minutes or something. And they pack in Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, Mary J, 50, Kendrick Lamar, M, and even people in the background, you know, who are kind of Easter eggs and all these little visuals. And
Anderson .Paak is doing the live drums for Eminem.
Right. So there's all these, and it's just packed in. And so there's that. Also, the visuals, also the performances and the song. And, you know, and Snoop just looks... He's
timeless.
A very good dancer, like on stage. I know that that's just kind of a stupid thing to say, but the way that he just kind of grooves, you know, he's just, mm-hmm. and he's just, he looks just so comfortable and just
you
so
wanna
like.
You want to be at the party that he's at, like whatever he's up to, it looks awful fun.
Yeah. He has a podcast and.
Oh, he does?
Yeah. And I listen to it sometimes and he's actually a really great interviewer. He's really nice and fun. He's really funny. One of the funniest episodes was when he had the guys from Trailer Park Boys. Did you ever watch that Canadian show?
No.
Oh, my goodness. I was obsessed with Trailer Park. It predated The Office and Parks and Rec and Workaholics and It's Always Sunny. But it's just like all those, and just as funny. But it's this very small kind of Canadian production. But anyway, Snoop Dogg has all those guys on. And anyway, it was just hilarious. But I was thinking... Even though this isn't really my style of music that I want to listen to, by far, I think it's my favorite performance. And, you know, Paul McCartney performed, Prince, mm-hmm. you know, Beyonce. These are really, Paul and Prince, and I suppose Michael, are people I genuinely listen to and have throughout my life. And somehow this performance, I just thought was just so interesting and so many things to talk about, you know, like when Eminem kneeled at the end, which I thought, you know, okay, you know, when I saw it, I just kind of registered it like, oh, I think he's doing a Kaepernick thing at this point. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of cool. And then, of course, the internet.
But he's always referencing, the whole song is you've got one chance, right? Like, right. It's the message of the song is, I mean, talk about our, like, performance moment. You sing a whole song about how your life is full of frustrations and you have to overcome.
Yeah.
And then he does this act at the end, you know, and is it like, is that his white privilege that he can do that act and none of the black performers do that act? But it's just, you know, it's the movement, it's the moment. And then he does that. And it was like, oh my God.
Yeah.
And I also thought, my first thought was, oh my God, he's so thankful to be there because he's been sober for 12 years and, you know, I know he dropped out of the spotlight on purpose, but it was just so interesting. Like, I just thought of it in the arc of his life. Like, he goes from this kid in a trailer park with an abusive family to playing the Super Bowl halftime show, where one of the hottest musicians of the moment is going crazy behind you, singing every lyric, playing their hearts out on the drums. Like, it was just so, like, that moment in itself is, I think, the most magic for me.
Yeah, it's just great to see the camaraderie and the togetherness and the solidarity and how, you know, that stadium is just right down the street from what I understand from Compton. And so, you know, it represents that. So what do you think the conservatives were saying about the performance afterwards? Rebecca, what do you think?
Well, I heard they didn't like Mary J's outfit, which is hysterical.
Yeah, what did they say?
They said, you know, too skimpy.
Which is hilarious because it's
the cheerleaders are like behind her wearing. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one, even if it was a bikini, it's like, who cares? She can wear what she wants to, shut up. But two, it's like on the scale of outfits that people wear on stage, it was, I don't think it was skimpy.
Yeah, and it was magical because who else has mirrored leopard boots? No one else.
Yeah.
Only Mary J.
Yeah. One conservative pundit, and I want to be clear that not every conservative would say this sort of thing. It was just some, right? And one was saying it was sexual anarchy. What do you think they mean by that? Sexual anarchy?
Well, if they were white, blackness, just blackness itself represents sexual anarchy.
Yeah.
I mean, there was sexuality present. There was, I mean, I don't think 50 Cent does anything that doesn't say like sex might happen after this. Like, you might listen to this song and then sex might happen. And he even, that's what, even one of the lyrics, he doesn't want to make love. He wants to have sex.
Yeah. I mean, okay. But at the same time, when I watched it, sexuality for me anyway wasn't front and center. That's not how it was being coded to me. What was being coded to me was like, was Compton and hip hop and all the things that they're basically saying, you know, like what you're saying about Eminem and his lyrics, and what Kendrick Lamar is talking about is depression and trying to convince himself that everything's going to be okay, you know, and the world sucks and my life sucks and materialism sucks and do I have friends and everything's going to be all right, right? And, you know, put me in a box and that kind of thing. So, but
that part
sexuality.
Yeah, I mean, they missed the boat. I mean, that scene where all those men come out of those boxes.
Yeah.
I mean, oh my God, what's her name? Missy Elliott does that in one of her videos as well. But like this, I mean, that is, you know, a message of you cannot hold Black art, Black lives down, right? Mm. They come back up. They rise back up. Yeah, if all you saw was sexual anarchy in that piece, I feel really sorry for you.
Yeah.
Because you missed, I mean, there were so many coded moments. Like, is Snoop Dogg wearing Crip colors or is he wearing Rams colors.
Yeah, I mean, it was clearly Rams inspired, and then he was, you know, throwing up Crip hand gestures. I don't know the lingo, but he was definitely shouting out to his gang, you know, sort of, I don't know what to say, some sort of gang thing. But, well, that brings me to another thing that people will say, is that it was glorifying gang violence. What do you think about that, Rebecca?
I think it was talking about what happens in people's lives. And right. Hip hop has always done that. It came out of the Bronx to tell the story of what people had, which was a record player and a microphone, to just talk about exactly what they saw going on in their lives every day.
Yeah.
That is what hip hop does.
As I'm watching, I don't know if this was your experience, I'm like, oh, wow. I mean, this actually feels kind of hip. You know, this feels actually kind of like of the time. And then I thought about it later and I thought, well, actually, Joe Burrow is younger. He was born after these guys, you know, not necessarily Eminem, but Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg had their hit songs. Mm-hmm. So it's not of the moment. It just, you know, felt like that. And then I went online and there were all these tweets and Instagram posts of millennials and whatever the next generation? Gen Z. So they were, you know, filming their parents jamming out to the halftime show. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. I mean, Gen Z, did you experience that with your son?
Oh yeah. I mean, he was like, oh, these are all your old favorite songs.
Yeah, like, it's like oldies,
yeah,
right? It's the oldies.
But God, they're good songs.
It's like
songs.
When our parents would listen to Elvis or something and start dancing. It was the same exact thing.
Yeah, I mean, when that whole Tupac part came up, I was like, oh, like, this is the music. You know, I never thought about hearing that song again live, because Tupac is dead, so that the fact that they were doing it was such an amazing homage to him. And Dr. Dre has that line of from Diego to the Bay, like that the world of Black California is so specific, and all of the music that comes out of it is so specific that I was just transported.
I was terrified they were going to bust out a hologram of Pac.
Oh.
Mm. And it didn't happen, but I was like, oh no. I just thought the whole thing was just perfectly performed. And, you know, and of course, another conservative, tweet storm is, this was racist against white people. What do you say to that, Rebecca?
If you're not able to accept Black joy, if you're not able to see that the NFL itself is built on Black bodies and destroying Black bodies, then maybe it is racist to you. It was a celebration during Black History Month in a sport that is completely dominated by Black men, celebrating Blackness.
Yeah.
And it was so exquisite.
Yeah.
I mean, all of the hydraulics of the stage going up and down, and like just thinking about space, like you're on the roof, which is like there's that old song about being on the roof, like it's that like sacred away space, and then you're in the home, and then you're on the street. Like it was just such an interesting display about life.
Mm-hmm.
I did think that my son is obsessed with the Impalas. I did think the Impalas were going to drive off, like in Grease lightning. Like that was the moment I was waiting for, is that they'd all get in the Impalas and then the Impalas would like float out of the stadium. I think that 15 minutes was probably very challenging if you are disturbed by Black culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was nothing in that 15 minutes but Black culture.
Yeah.
And how challenging that is. to some folks. I mean, and you know, Mary J rips into that no more drama and falls on the floor at the end of her performance. Like, that is not a white that is not a white performance.
Yeah.
You know, you don't end up splayed out because you've given absolutely everything that you have.
Yeah.
Because, you know, people have paid good money to see you. Like, that is a different experience.
Yeah. The one negative I'll say, Rebecca,
okay,
is lip syncing. So it bothers me. I don't think it bothers anyone else, but I won't say who, but there was some lip syncing and some not lip syncing, and then some in between where it was performing over
track.
Your own track.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I consider performing over your track to be like 80% great, you know? But there were some performances that were just completely live. It was just, you know, of course the backtrack is not live, but because you can't really do a backtrack in hip hop live, but the, you know, the vocal performances were live, but there were some that were just completely lip synced. And I get it because, you know, you don't want to leave it up to chance. You're moving around, things could go wrong, and they often do. And it's just easier because if you just have it pre-recorded, nothing's ever going to go wrong, and mm-hmm. you just can sit back and relax and enjoy the performance as a performer and as an audience member. But what do you think is wrong with me that I focus on it and that it bothers me?
Because you're a musician and you care. I mean, this is the same way when people are like, look at this amazing painting. And I can look at it and I can see that that's a vinyl painting. And then someone's taken like a painter's knife and put like three globs of real paint on it. And I'm just like, that's not art to me. And someone else is like, I love this painting. Isn't it amazing? But I'm like, if you've ever painted in your life, you know that that is like a vinyl print with three globs of paint.
It's the lip syncing of painting.
It is the lip syncing of painting. And I am disturbed by it.
Okay.
But, you know, I think if something is your craft and you understand how to produce your craft, it'd be the same way that both of us would be profoundly disturbed if there was a therapist bot.
Right.
Who just went.
Well, there are. You know, they do have therapist bots.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how do you feel about that?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And, you know, research shows that for some scenarios, it actually can help people, has improved outcomes. Of course, it's extremely limited at this point. You know, it just is.
And we hope till the end of our careers.
Yeah. I don't think I'm going to be out of work anytime soon. Let's just put it that way. All right, let's take a break and we get back. Patron emails, what do you say?
Okay.
Hey, deserving listeners, as you all know, I am constantly recommending that people go to therapy. We all need therapy from time to time. Well, one of the options available that is definitely worth checking out is BetterHelp. If you're looking for a therapist, I would give it a try by going to betterhelp.com/Kirk. Make sure you use the promo code Kirk because you get 10% off your first month, and it really helps us out. As you watch these videos, I know many of you have been motivated to find your own therapist, which is great because you deserve it. And I know also that it can be hard to find a good fit, find the right one for you. Well, one of the options available in terms of your shopping is to go to betterhelp.com/Kirk. I've been told you can start communicating with your therapist in under 24 hours. You can message your counselor at any time. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions. I've also been told that it's often less expensive than in-person therapy, and you should know that this service is available to clients worldwide. So go to betterhelp.com/Kirk to get 10% off your first month today. Okay, so we're back from the break. So anonymous patron wrote in and said, in many countries, divorce rates for lesbian women is higher than gay men. I was wondering, why do you think this is the case, Rebecca?
Well, lesbians move in faster. There is the famous joke I now know to credit to Leah Delaria of Big Boo fame from Orange is the New Black. So I'll just tell the joke. What does a lesbian bring on the first date?
What?
A U-Haul. So you get two people who are socialized to love and commit. And so they commit very, very quickly. And then that commitment can't stand both the regular pressures that relationships go through and the regular hormonal changes. But, you know, there's also all of this homophobia and heterosexism that make lesbian relationships hard. And you're both earning half the income of men, so you're doing it on a lot less money.
Yeah.
It puts a lot of stress.
So you think it's that if you default to moving in quickly and then thus maybe getting married quicker than you would under other circumstances, does it deny some lesbian couples the opportunity to really vet the relationship before moving forward? Do you think that's what you're saying?
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. There's also not a lot of room. If you think of the stereotypical experience that most women have in their relationship of, I'm not getting my needs met, I'm doing all the work. If you get two people who are both having that dynamic at the same time, whereas men, I think, are socialized a little bit more to like let more things go, focus on themselves more. I mean, I'm kind of fascinated. There's quite a dynamic right now of lesbian couples being on TikTok together or having joint accounts, and the joint account being about how much in love they are. And then one of these couples that I follow, the woman's on the Harlem Globetrotters and the other woman is a dancer. They just announced that they were separating. And it's like, not only are they separating, but like they have to give up their joint account. Like, it's so brutal to watch. And then there's this other couple that I'm watching. I don't even know how I ended up following them, but like every day is a post about their love. And I'm thinking, like, that is so much pressure.
Yeah.
How can a relationship sustain that?
Yeah. So do you see that among your friends, the divorce rates high?
Yeah. Fast and furious. I mean, a good friend of ours, so madly in love, so amazing. They got married, they got pregnant, they're on their second kid, and what? They're getting a divorce? Like, head spinning. I mean, I know this happens in straight couples too. I think in gay couples, it's more complicated because the friendship circles are more enmeshed. But I can just say, I know of like three other couples that have been together as long as me and Beth. Like, it is really rare.
How long have you been together?
25 years.
So what is it about the enmeshed friend group that complicates things?
Oy. Well, think about how you and your wife have separate, you can find your separate identity in your friend circles.
Yeah.
In lesbian relationships, that's not necessarily true. You might have all the same friends, and then there might be gender expectations that you are always together. Like, I'm always surprised how many people email me and Beth together or text me and Beth together. I think because they're not sure, like, who is the woman who would make the plans. Whereas I know they're straight friends, they're just emailing the woman. Look, I know they. But like for us,
which I have to say, as a straight cis dude, I'm the planner, and it has always boggled me that I can't plan, say, with my brothers. I have to plan with their wives, and I've always just been like, you can't text back, like you don't understand a calendar, like I know that they care,
right?
They probably care more than my sisters in law, but the socialization of that's women's work or something. I just don't understand that. It's bizarre.
Yeah, I know. It's really weird, but it's just constant for us.
Yeah.
So yeah, the dynamics,
so you don't have your own space is what you're saying. You don't.
I think that's why we're still together, is that we do have really separate friend spheres. But for a lot of lesbian couples, I mean, that's a huge deal in a breakup. Like, who gets the friends? basically.
Mm. Right.
Because you've combined your lives so intently, and people combine you as well. Mm. And, you know, I mean, there's that joke about lesbian couples dressing alike. Like, it's actually, I'll like wait till Beth gets dressed if we're going out together, and I'll look her up and down, and then I'll get dressed just so that we're different. Not that anybody puts us together. Like, we just did our 25th Valentine's Day, and we did not get red as a couple at all, even though we're out on Valentine's Day, just the two of us.
What do you mean you didn't get, like, people didn't acknowledge you as a couple?
Yeah.
What did they think you were?
You know, two matronly single ladies out on Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times we go out to eat and we're asked if we want separate checks.
Right.
And I'll say, no, we've been together 25 years. We do not want separate checks.
Right.
Like, joint bank account. Thank you. But that, so, you know, you're both like enmeshed, and then you don't get all of the privileges of being a couple because you don't get read as a couple.
Right.
I think I've told this story on the podcast several times of like, it always shows up when we travel and we get like separated at airports because we're not seen as a family. And it's especially in Turkey, we were in like the most kind of ridiculous, scary situation where I was like, you have passed my bag that has my passport, has gone with, I can't say it, but it's gone with my wife. It's on the other side of the metal detector. And you're questioning why I have no bags. Like, trying to explain, like, they're with my family on the other side of the metal detector. Please God, let me just.
So you couldn't say because why?
Because I think it's a crime in Turkey. I think you would get killed. Yeah. It's not legal.
Yeah.
TVX.
That must have been scary, right?
It was terrifying. There have been very few times where I've been absolutely terrified, and that was one of them where I was like, I cannot be truthful in this. I can say like my family, and luckily Beth and I kind of look alike, so they might accept. Or I could say like the person I'm traveling with took my person with all of our bags and passed them through. I am now standing here with no bags, but you know, I'm like trying to explain, like, just let me go over there and I'll be on my way.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think there's these subtle and not so subtle ways that kind of homophobia puts stress on a relationship. And I think the money is a huge factor. I mean, imagine going through your life if your income was always half. And so by the time you get to 50, you don't have a lot of the stability. I just see it really clearly in our lives with our compared to what our straight friends have compared to what we have.
And often feel more comfortable in the, you know, in city neighborhoods that are less oppressive of lesbians, where things are more expensive, like in right. San Francisco or Seattle, for example.
Yeah, you can buy a lot of comfort.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else. This is one of my favorite subjects to speak on. So I don't know if people know, but there is a group in town. I think they're called ABLE? No. Northwest Network. And it is a group specifically addressing domestic violence in the LGBTQIA+ community. Mm-hmm. And they also have relationship classes to teach queer folks how to be in relationships together. And I would say that's probably the number one thing that's missing in gay culture. There's a lot of focus on hooking up, being loved, but there's like zero focus on how to stay together, how to grow together. And in fact, when bringing baby home, I bring him up every single time we talk. Oh my God, what's his name? Gottman. When Gottman was doing his initial research on couples post-baby in Seattle, we tried to get in on the study. And we were told we can't allow gay people in the study. We're not, that variable hasn't been accounted for yet. Right. So no, you cannot learn these skills.
Right. Yeah, it's so dumb. It's like, what do you mean? Like, we're human beings that have a child. So what? What variable are you talking about exactly?
And now that I've seen what the content is, I was like, really? We couldn't go?
Yeah, that's pretty awful.
Yeah. That was a long time ago. I know they're open to gay couples now. But I thought it was so interesting that in their research phase, same-sex couples was too much.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I know where they come from. Of course, it's ridiculous, but it's similar to when pharmaceuticals will be tested on men, because and then we have problems with things like Ambien or other kinds of things, because this, you know, the dose is just assumed to be the same and the effects are assumed to be the same for women, which is sometimes not the case in some catastrophic ways. But the way that they think, it's like, well, we're trying to eliminate all the variants in the participants. We're trying to narrow down to these very specific variables, and if we introduce too many other variables, it'll one, make the data corrupted somehow, and also when people read the report, they'll say, oh well, you introduced another variable there, I wonder if that had played a factor that can't, and so it'll invalidate your findings to the broader research community. And so, because like with women with pharmaceuticals, from what I understand, they found that, well, some women are pregnant or can become pregnant during the trial, which one can really change things quite a bit for a human being's biology, but also can make it so that they shouldn't be taking that trial of medication. Mm-hmm. And it's just easier and more convenient. But of course, it denies, and to some extent plays into, well, to a large extent, plays into the invisibilizing of women and the invisibilizing of gay and lesbian people. Because it's like, well, you know, we'll get to them later. And they don't really matter anyway. So, you know, let's just stick to men and hetero people and that kind of thing. And so I've heard the researchers talk along these lines. And it's getting better. But anyway. So... well, any other factors you can think of as to why lesbians have a higher rate of divorce?
Well, we've talked about how women initiate divorce
more
anyways.
Often. Yeah.
So I think the idea that, you know, I'm self-actualized and I can move on and I can find something better.
Yeah. So for those who don't know, in heterosexual marriages, on average, women are more likely to initiate divorce. I don't know the exact percentage, you know, 60-70%, but it's, you know, pretty consistent over time, where when you ask divorcing couples who initiated it among heterosexual couples, they'll more often identify the wife. Why do you think that is?
I think more in heterosexual, or I think in heterosexual.
Either, I guess.
Okay.
Either, really.
Yeah. I mean, I think for heterosexual women, it's because more of the burden has been put on them in the relationship. Right. I think for gay women, there's so much stress already.
Yeah.
At this idea that, and, you know, addictions can be really high. You know, people may not have family support. They may not be that functioning. There are some, you know, mental illness and addiction are really prevalent for queer people because there's a lot of oppression and a lot of estrangement from support systems.
And my brief foray into the data, I think it was found that lesbian divorce rate is higher than gay men divorcing. So what do you think that difference is, other than what you've already talked about?
Well, gay men have more money. So they can have more time apart, more lives apart. I mean, I don't know the statistics on this, and I don't want to get into the promiscuity myth. But I think of the relation, this is just my self-report, that gay male relationships tend to be more open or allowing of sexual exploration outside of the marriage, outside of the partnership. I don't know, gay men want to be perceived as perfect and are willing to suffer more. I'm not sure.
Well, tell me about that. I mean, that's not true for lesbian women?
I don't think so. Not in my generation. I mean, generationally for me, the gay men that I knew had to be much more perfect. And this was also in the age of AIDS too, where they were already seen as, you know, tainted. So the idea that, you know, your home was immaculate and you were perfect and there was nothing to see here, whereas the lesbians I was socialized in, it was way more, I'm going to let my problems hang out right out, you know, right what's going on with me, no filter, you know, like no questions about what was going on in someone's life. They were right out on the table.
Yeah. Does that have to do with anti-socialization to some extent? Like, okay, I recognize that society is wrong in a number of ways because they've been saying I'm a bad person because I'm lesbian. So that gives me a chance to evaluate female socialization. And then I'm going to push back on that aspect as well.
Yeah. I mean, everything's up for question. Body types. I mean, I would say for me, the positivity around fatness culture comes out of queer culture for me. I've seen way more of it in queer culture than I've seen it in straight culture. This idea that there's one body type and we all have to have it. If you poke around in queer culture at all, there is so much more fatness. In fact, yesterday I showed my kid this piece on TikTok that was like a fatness magical thinking animation, where this woman like scratches into her stomach and then the whole universe appears. It's done with like stop motion animation. It was my kid was like, what am I watching? And I was like, I think we're watching fatness magical realism. I'm not quite sure, but it's very interesting. So more acceptance with body types, more acceptance, you know, almost to a fault, of admitting what isn't right in the world. I mean, all of this stuff, that all of the isms, the veganism, you know, this is all heavily rooted in queer counterculture. That, you know, I'm going to look at the planet. I'm going to look at what's not working. I'm going to look at my own family dynamics. I'm going to create a new family. I'm going to speak truth to power. Like, these are all kind of inherent queer liberation concepts.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't think I've ever heard it really in that way. And it makes a lot of sense, of course, and is anecdotally true from my observation as well. And we, as a society, particularly as progressives, really have should have a lot of gratitude towards the queer community over the past 50 years to push us forward in that way.
Well, and so much of it came out of AIDS. I mean, when you are, just like so much came out of the Vietnam War, when you are 18, 21, losing all of your friends, 25, by the time you're 25, you've lost every lover you've ever had. You do a lot of reassessment about what society is.
Well, and then when you have Reagan and others,
woo,
just actively saying it's your fault and who cares about you and you deserved it or whatever, then you start to question authority a little bit.
Yeah. Do you know who Annie Sprinkle is?
No.
Okay. So she is one of the big activists that came out of that time, a sex educator. She now has a PhD in sexology. She just has a new book out about eco-sex, about literally having sex with the planet. And one of her early concepts that came out of ACT UP and all of that amazing street activism was to dedicate your orgasms to people it came out of mourning the dead, mourning people who were dying of AIDS, and she would dedicate her orgasms to people who needed her life force.
What is that? Is that like I dedicate my next orgasm, or in the middle of orgasm, their dedication? And what does that look like exactly?
I mean, it could be either way. You could try, why don't you try it both ways and report back? but it's actually been, I don't bring it up obviously with every client, but occasionally I'll bring it up with clients who are really struggling with someone in their lives who's like, you know, relapsed or is truly in pain. And I'll bring up this concept from Annie Sprinkle about dedicating an orgasm to them, which is really, you know, a lot of religions have this of like dedicating life force in that direction. And clients are often like really taken aback and really think about it. And it's interesting to think about, like, this is a concept that came out of queer culture during the AIDS epidemic, that like we, everything we have is a life force and we can choose to use it for good. Our sexuality is a positive life force on the planet, as opposed to the myth that we had been told, which is, you know, your sexuality will kill you and anyone you get near.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting.
I can't wait to hear the YouTube comments.
If you're commenting below, tell us who you're going to dedicate your next orgasm to. No judgment.
Let's really get it going.
No judgment.
I think this could be a powerful shift in our cosmos. Who needs your next orgasm?
Yeah. And how? Do you shout it out in the middle? Or do you just make note before and after?
And if you've never checked out Annie Sprinkle's work, here's someone to go do a deep dive in. She's one of the massive, she just won a Guggenheim grant. Like it's one of the massive, a little lesser known, everyone knows RuPaul, but how many people know Annie Sprinkle?
Yeah. Patron Lauren from Texas says, this is a question for Kirk and Rebecca. One of my friends went through a traumatic breakup. I wanted to be there for her, but the more she told me about the relationship, the more I realized that the situation was far beyond my capabilities as her friend to help her with. Mm-hmm. The relationship involved domestic abuse, and hearing about this is personally triggering for me. Attempting to help her was actually hurting both of us, as I needed to break up from the friendship. I told her this in the kindest way possible and have since stopped communication with her, but she continues reaching out to me, attempting to smooth things over with me. She thinks that my lack of response means that I no longer want to be her friend altogether. I have considered clarifying the boundary with her, but I feel like I made myself clear already. Also, she is in crisis, and she's very easily confused right now, so I'm concerned that any attempts on my part to communicate with her could be taken the wrong way by her and could harm her or our relationship. Am I being a bad friend? Lauren asks you, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, we all need to have boundaries. I can't tell you how often I hear this story, that I think we don't have a lot of language to talk about how bad things are when they're happening. And so when we finally are ready to tell the whole story, it can be extremely overwhelming to be on the other side of that. So that's one piece of this. You are totally allowed to set boundaries with your friend at any time. I think we also live in a very kind of black and white, unnuanced culture. And so it's hard for people to see that you can't be there for everything. So I would hope that you guys can find your way back to each other. But I support your choice to take space. You're right. Not all of us can process our friend's trauma. That's just, it's not possible.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think I have anything more to say to that other than beyond establishing your boundary and just feeling like, you know, okay with it, to additionally, in your free time or in therapy, investigate what it is about this situation that is triggering to you, because you're suffering at someone else's suffering, and healing you deserve. That's like the way Yoda would say it, right? And so it's a indication, a barometer, if you will, for maybe the next chapter of your own healing. Not that you have to, and not that it's your fault, but you know, that would be a direction. The other thing I would say is that I've been challenged by in this way with some friends, not in the last number of years, but in my past. And what I've done, for better or for worse, is I listen, but I'm not listening. Yeah, you know, I'm there for them, but I'm not there for them, You know, there's a version of me that's all in, where I'm like, I'm there for you. There's another version of me where I'm like, I'm there, and I'll be a good friend, and I'll hear you, and I'll track what you're saying, but I'm not, like, invested. And that's a middle ground that I have utilized at times so that I don't get crushed in the issue.
Is that your therapy bot space?
Yeah. I just say, wow, that must be hard for you. Tell me more. Anonymous patron wrote in and said,
oh, can I say one more thing?
Please.
It's okay to set limits with your friends too and say, you know, I can listen for about 20 minutes, but then we got to talk about something else.
Right. Yeah. I want to just talk about the other things we used to talk about. Could we do that, please? Yeah.
Yeah. Or can we just watch a movie together?
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I have been very open with my friends, like, hey, I'm doing trauma therapy 20 hours a week during a pandemic. So, like, let's check in for like 20 minutes about how rough our own lives are. And then let's go to a plant sale and just look at the plants and smell them. And yeah, or come with me to an estate sale and let's just look at all the objects.
There must be good estate sales in your neck of the woods by Seward Park.
There are amazing estate sales. And for those people who wish they could attend more estate sales, there is estatesale.net where you type in the zip code and it shows you all the upcoming estate sales in your area.
Is estate sale just code word for rich garage sale?
Curated garage sale. Curated by somebody else who does this professionally.
Oh, really?
Yes. So
it's
like
not just like your teenagers standing over a bunch of junk. It's like a company comes in and says, well, that's going to sell, that's not going to sell, that kind of thing.
And they sort. So everything, if you're lucky, you know, all the spoons are together, all the kitchen stuff's ready to go.
One is room it a is sad affair because people have died?
If you go to an estate sale, there's only one estate sale that I've been to, which was, it was clear this person was a hoarder because I purposely went on the third day due to the pictures. And even on the third day, people were tripping over the stuff. But it was clear that this person was very loved in the neighborhood because all the neighbors were seeing each other and they were so happy to see each other. But like no one was saying, oh, my God, I've never been allowed into this house and I'm a little overwhelmed. Mm. I did find an amazing vintage box of watercolor paints in a metal tin. I mean, it just this paint is very old. So, yeah, but if you're stepping
into
it,
seems like it'd be carcinogenic, possibly. Right?
If you're
like it's made of asbestos or something, or like iridium or some sort of radioactive material. Just like glow in the dark, Rebecca, because stay away from
no,
it.
No, but if you step into an estate sale, you already know what's gone down. Like, it's kind of, I don't know how else to say this.
You're accepting
it's
that death is a part of life.
Death is a part of life. And, you know, most of us have a lot of crap. Like, you are entering into a story well into progress.
Oh, that's interesting. Right. So with garage sales, it's people clearing out the boxes in their attic. In estate sales, it's literally everything in the house.
Yeah. So wow. Say they really liked something that you liked, or say you're looking for something specific.
Boba Fett dolls?
Boba Fett dolls. There's a lot of Star Wars stuff that shows up at estate sales. Hmm. But also, like, if you were into Elvis, if you were into toy cars, that stuff shows up. Beanie Babies, DVDs.
Did you have Beanie Babies back in the day?
I was not a Beanie Baby person.
Yeah. I feel like our generation was too old to have received them from our parents and too young to afford them or care, you know?
Right.
Like, I don't remember caring about
Beanie
Babies.
We just needed pants at that point.
Like, yeah, and Value Village had plenty of pants for $2. Mm-hmm. You know? And some of them didn't smell, so you could buy those.
I will say one of the most fascinating estate sale businesses that I've seen. I ran into this woman at a Puyallup giant junk stall sale. And she clearly ran estate sales. And then after they were over, she would collect all of the junk jewelry, you know, that or costume jewelry.
Yeah, yeah.
So not precious stones, but like, you know,
yeah,
things that you can just buy. And then she had a second business where she sorted all of that jewelry into trays. So like a Halloween tray, giant gold necklaces, giant pink necklaces. And then she brought these to other sales and there were hundreds of trays and her booth was just packed. And you just looked through junk that was already not purchased at a junk sale. And now it was treasure because it had been reorganized. And I just thought that was one of the most amazing business models I've ever seen. So she's literally, I mean, it's like people who go to the bins and then resell those clothes. Like this, these things have no value on their own, but you put a ton of them together and you bring them to a third place and all of a sudden they have tons of value.
I wish that I could wear, well, I could, but I wish I could stand to wear costume jewelry because whenever I see it, I just think that's glorious. But I feel too claustrophobic. I can barely wear my wedding. Well, actually, my wedding ring doesn't bother me in the least. It's like this perfect fit. It's tight, but not too tight. And I've never had something like this before. I can't wear a watch. I can't wear anything because it bothers me. It like gets on my nerves.
Well, I will say that Zoom has been the death of my costume jewelry collection because with the headphones and like it just doesn't work. But I love a big chunky necklace. I almost want to get all the stuff I got out of that woman's sale. I got the perfect necklace for the next time I see Joan Jett. It's this giant acrylic 3D black heart that's got rhinestones in it. I also got an owl ring where the owl is like an inch and a half tall.
Mom wears stuff like that.
Ooh, I love
recreationally it. And has always worn stuff like that.
And what does she get out of that?
She loves it. Yeah. She's a very bright, extroverted, not conscious, self-conscious. Well, at least in that way, sort of woman. And so maybe I get that from her. I don't know.
But with COVID, like the masks and the earphones, it makes I wear a lot less of my jewelry. It's just not as fun.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about fashion and personal like practices during pandemic because we had a reprieve for about 6 months until Omicron, but it's interesting to think about how I've changed so much because before the pandemic, I didn't have many clothes. I pretty much just wore the same. I think I literally wore the same pair of pants for like 5 years straight. And had like a rotating set of black t-shirts. And that's pretty much all I wore. But I was in public, right? So you'd think I'd be more concerned about fashion at that point. So it wasn't like I was unfashionable. Like anyone would probably call me.
You just look like you live in Seattle.
Yeah.
You had like the Seattle uniform on.
Yeah. I look like an older metrosexual, as they used to call us, you know? But during the pandemic, I think it was the boredom and also being on camera a lot more on my YouTube channel, also Zoom, that I just felt like I wanted to, you know, zhuzh it up a little bit. And so I started buying all these shirts. And well, actually, so a big part of it was during my reaction videos, I started realizing in the beginning when I first started doing reaction videos, I just thought I'll just wear the same sweater every single video because it just makes it easier that way. I don't have to think about what to wear and of course it was just a black sweater. No one's going to care. And immediately people started caring and Stacy started telling me you can't wear the same thing. You need and I'm like, but I don't have anything else to wear. I have other black sweaters I could wear, but so I suddenly was faced with having to buy all this stuff, you know. And then there's that. Then there's the pants situation, you know, because like
I've only seen you in shorts in the last 3 years.
Yeah. So there's been an evolution. So before the pandemic, I never wore sweatpants. Very rarely. I pretty much just wore jeans to work and home. Like, I just wore jeans all the time. And occasionally I'd wear nice slacks or something if something was happening. And then the pandemic happened. And it's just like, well, what doesn't matter what happens below the belt, because I'm on Zoom. No one can see it. So I started wearing these old sweatpants and then over time, I evolved eventually to shorts, because shorts are even more comfortable than sweats. And I did all this research about, like, I now feel like I'm very good at buying clothes online, because before I was never good at that, because how are you supposed to tell what it looks like, right, or feels like, yeah, or fits? And now I feel like I have it all kind of, I'm dialed in. I don't need to go to the mall ever again. Like these shorts that I'm wearing right now, they're Amazon Basics.
You're very high class.
Yeah, and I bought these, and I was like, okay, these are perfect. It has a pocket that zips up, so it'll, you know, if I'm walking around with my phone. And so I bought like 10 pair.
Well, it's funny, because I do the woman of a certain age with a certain body type version of that, which is, there are certain brands that I know actually fit a perimenopausal woman's body.
What is that? What's that?
It tends to, you know, not everyone ages the same, but it is very common to put on 3 to 5 inches in your waist, and nothing you do will impact it. It's just the shape of your body now. It's like, it's just what happens. And so there are these couple of brands, like Universal Standard. I basically have a uniform of either Universal Standard or Eileen Fisher, mix and match. It's like Granimals for women of a certain age. Like,
well, I tell you, there's nothing more forgiving than an elastic waistband on pair of Amazon Basic shorts. So,
well, did you ever watch Project Runway?
No.
Oh. Oh my God, what's his name? There's the male co-host of that show for years and years and years. Oh my God, he's gay. I can't remember his name. But anyways, he always was in a three-piece suit with a kerchief and a matching tie.
Christian Siriano?
Tom. Oh my God. Tom. Someone will know.
Tom and Lorenzo.
Tom Gunn. Okay. So Tom Gunn would say, you cannot go to work in your pajamas. And so the joke in our house is, yes, Tom, but if, you know, if it's 100% cotton, if it's a flattering cut, like,
yeah, I mean, I get the mentality, you know. For some people, it's like, if you, and some people would do this during the Zoom times, is they would dress up for work, because for them to still wear their sweats, they don't get into the mindset of work. And I have to say, for me, that is just not true. And in some ways, the pandemic has kind of broke me on outdoor clothing, because when I put jeans on now, which are arguably extremely casual, right? Not by Seattle standards, but by world standards. And when I put jeans on now, it bothers me. I'm like, I feel so restricted by loose dad jeans. And I'm like, I think I'm permanently broken, and I'm going to look like Sinbad and, you know, just wearing these voluminous outfits. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Well, I remember it must have been around this time last year, because we were at the garden store, and I put on clean but pandemic clothes, like clean sweatpants, clean shirt, went to the garden
store.
And
cotton.
But comfortable, right. I'm going to be lifting up plants. And I ran into an old friend of mine, and they were in jeans and a button-down shirt. And I was like, oh my God, I gotta get my shit together. Like, I was just like, I have left the house looking like I'm going to throw the garbage out. And like, I might run into an old friend, and I want to look a little bit more put together.
Yeah.
So I do get dressed for work every day.
Well, you look nice now. You look actually like you're going to go to church or something. You look.
This is a very, this pocket, this shirt has pockets. This is from, this is by Mercy. It's a She's an Israeli designer. Look how voluminous this is. Like,
yeah,
I mean,
but it looks,
it's just,
it looks, very, very fashionable.
Yes. Well, I have a lot of clothes like this now that are technically pajamas, but in very nice fabrics with very nice cuts. It's darted. It's A-line. Yeah, but I don't know how to wear jeans anymore. It really showed up when we were traveling this time and we got to Florida and like everyone was in jeans. And I was like, oh, right. We were there so long that I actually went to Ross Dress for Less and found a pair of like $4 jeans. Because I've forgotten how to dress in public.
Yeah. Well, I forgot how to act in public. I forgot how to act in person with friends. I got a little bit better just before Omicron, but I feel like I'm regressing again where I feel like my social skills have taken a serious hit. Like I think back on parties that I threw that I invited you to, but you just refused to come.
I want to come so desperately.
And I'm like ruminating on stupid stuff that I said or did. And I feel like I would have done that in my 20s or something before I learned how to socialize better. I feel like I've forgotten those things, but anyway.
It's hard to go back out. I think I don't know if it was technically, it was pretty close to a panic attack in the grocery store the other day, where like I could handle being in the grocery store. With Omicron, I didn't go to the grocery store at all. And I went back in and I was fine when I kept moving. I was actually fine putting everything on the conveyor belt. But when it got to the point where like you just stand there, then I was like, it's too much. Like too many people, too close. Everyone's moving in and out. Like I just realized we're just not around people anymore.
Yeah.
It's pretty freaky.
Well, and you know, if you're a rational, science-oriented human being, you understand that every 10 human beings is a walking vector for something that will kill you or others or give you long COVID. You know, it's like we've never been in this position before where even nice people who are doing everything they're supposed to do could still get it and be asymptomatic and spread it. So
I do have two of the when you have the predeterminers, there's a better word for it than that, for long COVID.
Oh, really?
I'm currently no longer pre-diabetic. Did I tell you that I get diagnosed as pre-diabetic?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So I was, here's a classic COVID story for everyone. If you sit on the couch for a year and eat nothing but pudding and you have diabetes on both sides, you become pre-diabetic. And so I cut out white rice, potatoes, and alcohol for 9 months, and my blood sugar went back down. I'm no longer pre-diabetic.
Oh, yay.
Yay. But, you know, diabetes is one of the factors for long COVID. And then also mono getting reactivated in your system is another factor.
Really?
Yeah. And I have a bad history with adult mono.
So mono is one of those things you always have?
Well, most people have it, and then it's always in your system, but it's not active. But I have had adult mono outbreaks on and off throughout my adult life.
Is that just like the flu or something?
It's like you just are non-functional. You're so exhausted, you just can't do anything. Have you seen my tongue?
Show me your tongue. Oh, you have ridges. There's like a Grand Canyon's in your tongue.
I know.
Is that mono?
That is my acupuncturist believes that each one of those slashes is a mono flare, is a mono flare that my body took a long time to recover from. That is not a tongue of a healthy person. Yeah. If you are any acupuncturist out there, know that every time my acupuncturist looks at my tongue, he sighs and says, I always forget how bad it is.
Oh.
Mono's pretty active in my system. And when I heard that those two things were for long COVID, I got, you know, the freak out comes and goes, and the freak out spiked there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, by the time this posts, because,
we'll be,
you know,
out.
Omicron, the wave sort of washed away from wherever it was originating, you know, to the east of us. And so the wave of Omicron it took a while for it to get to Seattle, and so it's taking a while for it to subside here in Seattle. I think we're behind a lot of other places. And although reports say that it's less deadly, it's massively contagious, even for people who are vaccinated.
My neighbor worked 9 consecutive shifts as an ER doctor because there was no one else to cover them.
Wow.
Like, I mean, they said to him on the
9. How long are the shifts?
He worked 9 days in a row. He was supposed to get a day off, and they said,
but he slept.
Right. But they said, hey, you have to come in tomorrow because there's no one else.
Right.
Like, there's no bodies left to cover this job. So please come and cover. But I don't know what your source is for Omicron news, but I've been.
You said it again, Omicron.
What is it? How should
it's
I say?
It's easier to say. And you listen to Joe Biden. I think he called it Omicron.
How should I say it? Omicron.
Omicron.
I'm never going to get it right.
Omicron is easier to say. It's funner to say.
I also used to say the pan epidemic. Instead of the pandemic. Yeah. This is the dyslexia creeping in. So Omicron. So the New York Times has this really great graphic. It's a map, and no color would be good, but then it's yellow to very dark purple, almost black. And just very suddenly over the last 24 hours, Seattle, Washington State went from very dark orange to light orange. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, the rates I follow almost every day, especially as, because I really need a haircut. And and I really need my eyebrows to be trimmed because that's one. I could do it myself, but it's just so much more skillful when the hairstylist does it. And because I've been cutting my hair again, and I feel like I forgot how to cut my own hair. I really figured it out during the, the big lockdown of 2020. But I really need a haircut. So that's why. Plus, I'm just done. I don't want to do this anymore, Rebecca. And so I've been following the trends, and the rates of infection on 7-day average is back down to the way it was mid-December at this point. Mm-hmm. So if we felt comfortable in mid-December, then we should feel comfortable now, as long as there isn't a new variant and da-da-da, right?
Except so, we feel so damaged that it's hard to be like, woo-hoo, let's go back outside.
Yeah, it's weird. True. And especially because the vaccine apparently doesn't. Because when I first, back in March and April, I felt invincible. I was, because that's the way the science was at the time. It was like the chance of you getting it is like very low at that point if you were vaccinated, especially like recently vaccinated. And so I just felt like, I was 100% fine. I mean, I knew there was a percentage chance, but as long as I'm not like making out with someone that's symptomatic, I'm probably going to be okay.
Because I know you have that fetish for chronic coughing.
I do. Like, come here. Let's French kiss. And but this time it's completely different. I feel like I'm not even really vaccinated anymore because of the way Omicron, or Omicron, as we like to say, is evading the and I want to get a second booster, and I mm-hmm. talked to my doctor. I was like, I want my second booster, and I was going back and forth with him, and then eventually he's like, that I'm not in charge of that. Mm-hmm. You can just get it, like just go to a pharmacy. I'm like, oh, well, why am I talking to you? So he's like, just go to a pharmacy. They'll probably give you a booster, even though it's only been 4 months,
Well, that's what they're saying. At 4 months, the effectiveness goes down significantly.
Right.
And so I think I got my booster in October, which would.
Yeah.
And we're about to travel again to Florida to check in on my mom. So I would get it. But then also for me, I have to factor in, and I'm flattened out for a day. So I have to budget in my post-vax day now as a rest day. Right. There's all these things that we didn't know that we would need before these times and the now times.
Post-vax days and 10 pairs of Amazon basic shorts that are all different colors.
And, you know, a nice A-line cut. Nice and a nice fabric.
Yeah. Breathable.
Mm-hmm. Light.
Well, final word on today's episode, Rebecca.
You say Omicron, I say Omicron.
In a very awkward manner. And everyone out there, please take care of yourself, because
we need you to listen to this podcast. Otherwise, we don't get to keep doing it.